This is a ripoff. This is an injustice.
This is The Impromptu, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. And now, your hosts for today, Michael Norton and me, Alex Knight.
So, you had a heck of a time last night.
Yeah, yes I did. Yes I did. Adventures in WordPress reconstruction. Lesson learned, I am going to audit the heck out of plugins that I choose to use on a test server in a local environment before I deploy them to production. Kids, never deploy stuff to a production environment that is sacred without... Yeah. Just don't do it. What happened was basically I had some kind of rogue plugin that effectively destroyed WordPress. Everything started getting really slow. Like I noticed sometimes just editing a post and trying to save it, the page would just time out and error out. Just everything was extremely slow. And I started examining the size of my database. Now, the WordPress installation had less than 100 posts in it, and the database was 231 megabytes. And yeah, that's not normal because I have like another WordPress site that has like, I think 500 and something posts, way more data, and that database is like 5 megabytes. So I don't know what happened. I never did find out exactly what caused the bloat, but after going through and kind of eliminating plugins, I have a feeling I know which one caused it. So I ended up having to spend all night basically installing WordPress from scratch in a subdirectory. So fresh database as well, then importing the posts from the old installation, and then just manually having to, like painfully having to edit each individual post and re-add all the featured images. Because that's another thing I found out with WordPress. If you just copy over a directory of images, even if the file names are exactly the same, there's some kind of weird association in the database to those posts where you have to like remove the featured image and then re-add it and then save the post again just to get it to show up. It was just the biggest pain in the butt. I have a love-hate relationship because I love WordPress if it's done right, but it's not exactly WordPress's fault if some rogue plugin leaves some cruft behind and does something stupid to your database. But the fact that that can even happen, the fact that it allows it, is questionable, and that makes me think this... I think there's more to be done on WordPress's end that shouldn't allow that more. I don't know if sandbox is the right environment, but some kind of more isolated environment for each plugin that would possibly prevent like catastrophic issues like that.
Yeah, it's kind of been a long-standing problem with WordPress. The old saying about iOS, oh, there's an app for that. With WordPress, it's, oh, there's a plugin for that. And there are hundreds of thousands of plugins out there.
Right.
Some of them very well documented, very stable, very
sure.
Regularly developed. But then there's a minefield of plugins that do all sorts of crazy things. And on top of that, there's plugins that don't work with other plugins or cause weird unintended effects when used in concert with other plugins. So it's kind of a black forest of weird little monsters running around. And some of them are helpful and some of them will murder you and steal your change.
Yeah, it actually reminds me of Firefox.
Oh yes.
Years ago, do you remember like in older versions of Firefox,
the extensions were, yes,
the extensions were particularly bad, where you if you had a lot of them installed, it would completely bring the browser down to a crawl. And Firefox for the longest time had this bad reputation for being a slow browser, and oftentimes like out of the box it was fine. The problem was the plugins, but again, there has to be some onus on the manufacturer, like of the browser, or in this case WordPress, the CMS, for not having a system that is designed where stuff like this can actually happen. But it's so hard. WordPress is such a big behemoth. And
yeah, I think it speaks to the open source model a bit. It's like in developing this platform, WordPress has basically said, oh, hey, you guys can do whatever you want, basically. And, you know, we're offering this software to you for free for you to do with as you will. And if it breaks, it breaks. That's your problem. But on the other hand, as the developers of this platform, it is kind of their responsibility to, as you said, ensure that these things can't cause catastrophic damage. It's something that Apple does all the time. Like, people always, a lot of people harp on about the walled garden, but in a lot of ways that ends up working out to Apple's advantage, because they say, look, here are the rules of the road. You can do this with our platform, but you can't do this because it would break the phone, or it would break the tablet, or it would break the person's laptop. So by setting those guidelines, they're saying, look, yeah, you can tinker around, you can add all these crazy things that do all this wonderful stuff, but we're not letting you do these things in particular that can harm the overall experience for the user. And I think as a mature platform, WordPress really should take steps to add that to their ecosystem, because, I mean, for the most part, it's all right, but these problems do crop up over and over again. And I think if they took just a little bit more responsibility for it, they could probably clean up the platform and make plugins better for everyone overall.
I agree, but there's also some things that I really question why they're not standard in the CMS. Like, what, I had a plugin for the longest time that did it was a very simple task, and all its job was to basically grab a featured image in a post and insert it in the RSS feed. That is such a basic piece of functionality. Like, and I see so many people complain, like, they're confused. I take this time to add these beautiful images to my posts and they don't even show up in the RSS feed. And the fact that you need a plugin to include the thumbnail of that image is mind blowing to me. Like, and I found out last night when I was rebuilding everything, I decided, of course, because I, you know, being burned by plugins, I decided I'm going to try to do the manual way of adding this functionality that I want. So I found a way to actually to add a filter in my functions file that basically grabs the medium-sized thumbnail and inserts it into the feed, which is a nice clean way of doing it without being concerned about some plugin that you don't know, you're not entirely sure what is this doing. And you know, sometimes even just uninstalling plugins, they leave files behind that they shouldn't be leaving. They leave tables in your database that they shouldn't be leaving. And those should be cleaned up. All sorts of stuff like that. Just, it really freaks me out now. After having a bad experience like that. But, and I've seen newer CMSs that, and again, I don't understand why WordPress hasn't done it. Like, there are things like, including the featured image in a post in your RSS feed should be standard. Like, why doesn't WordPress automatically include Facebook open graph tags and Twitter cards? Like, that's, if you look at Ghost as a CMS, they do that by default for you. You don't have to code anything. That's like, these are like modern social media features that you shouldn't need several different plugins in order to add open graph tags. Like, yeah, I know how to go in and add tags myself, but not everyone knows how to do that. Not everyone should have to do that. So stuff like that, like, and I can't believe that it's because they're worried about feature bloat in the app, because there's so many things that people expect it to have in 2015 that it doesn't. And so, like, I just, it drives me nuts.
In a lot of ways, their tech stack is very behind. It's all in PHP and MySQL. It's all very, very old underpinnings, very old legacy code on top of legacy code. Like, and they are taking steps to kind of try and update it. There is in development a WordPress JSON API that's going to become part of WordPress core, and they did just release a really awesome new HTML front end for WordPress.org, codenamed Calypso, which is a much sleeker admin interface than I think WordPress has ever done, ever.
Yeah, because the current interface is still, it looks like 10 years old.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny because they updated the theme like only a few versions ago, but yeah, it still looks very dated. And so they have this new one, and I'm thinking once they've integrated the JSON API into WordPress core, they'll say, well, now that we can get all this data from the WordPress database without having to go to the step of pulling things from MySQL directly, we can now bring Calypso in as the default admin interface for WordPress, period. And from there, once they have a more modern admin interface and a more modern method of getting and setting database information, they'll be in a much better position to start looking at, okay, now that we have this starting, this new starting point, what can we improve? What can we fix? What can we update? Because once you have that underpinning, you're in a much better position to make real changes.
My big concern is how would one even begin to transition from the old WordPress, though, with everything being PHP driven, like migrating data like seamlessly? That's going to be tough. Because what about all the, I mean, none of these plugins would work too, right? And that new, I would assume that none of these plugins would work.
No.
They would all have to be rewritten.
I think they would probably have to introduce a transition phase where it's like, okay, this is what we intend to do with the platform. It's going to be JavaScript, HTML, and CSS from now on. If you want to write a plugin, it has to look like this and talk like this and only do these things. And theming now looks like this. But if you install this transitionary version, all your old stuff will work and you'll be able to slowly migrate everything to the new system. Obviously, this would piss a lot of people off, but
there's no way to make progress, though, on such an old system without actually radically changing this.
I think if WordPress wants to grow, if WordPress wants to evolve into the future, it's just something that they're going to have to suck it up and do at some point. And if not now, I don't know when. Like, I think this is just something that they need to do now and get it out of the way so that they can focus on future growth and development.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I experienced yesterday too is, when I originally set up the CMS, and I had never encountered this before because I never set up WordPress with the intention of using it for podcasting, because I've only used WordPress as a blogging platform, which is very, very basic. Like, even on my other site, I've never used categories or anything like that. So it was just like straightforward, simple, you know, simple post structure. It was fine. But now with podcasts, having a podcast network and having to have different shows, You had to add those, like each show is basically a category in WordPress, but like the naming conventions like are just so dumb. Like having the word category in your URL makes it look so ugly and unnecessary. And the fact that you can use plugins to actually remove this without any kind of side effect, it's like, why is this in there? I don't want my URL to be mywebsite.com/category/the name of my show. Like, yeah, it's so bad.
It's hard to say exactly where any of this came from, because WordPress has kind of been this way for years.
Well, that just, it speaks to the age, and like those decisions were probably made like 10 years ago, and this is just cruft.
Yeah, I think the root of the problem is WordPress was developed for blogging. And just blogging, like just a person writing posts every day or every other day or every week or whatever about whatever they wanted to talk about. That's what it was built around. And now, however many years later, people are trying to use it for everything. So I think the disconnect comes from the entire platform was intended for this one very small niche. And now the use cases have ballooned to hundreds of other things. And the base system isn't able to cope with all of those use cases because it's still only designed for that one thing.
Right.
So,
and I'm sure it probably was never built with the intention of scaling up to massive websites with a ton of data. Like, I mean, WordPress is now, is, I think it's one of the most popular like e-commerce CMSs out there. Like, we have massive websites using this CMS. And like, WordPress was, you know, like you were saying, WordPress was designed and marketed as a blog, like a simple blogging tool back in its infancy. But now, like, we don't refer to it as a blogging tool. It's just called a CMS, a content management system, because it can just do, it can do anything with the right amount of tweaking.
Yeah. And for the most part, CMSs are fairly generic and you could build whatever you wanted on it. But WordPress is still incredibly opinionated. It basically assumes that you want to make a blog, and you end up having to fight it if you don't want to make a blog.
I almost feel like, you know, Automattic, the company that owns and maintains WordPress, they have their own plugin called Jetpack, which is a suite of like 20 something plus different pieces of functionality rolled into it. And it kind of makes me feel like that is sort of like a test bed for like stuff that maybe they think should be in core but isn't for whatever reason. Maybe it's because they just don't want to clutter this kind of brittle old product, or because they, you know, I think it's partly maybe that angle, but maybe it's just because, like, why don't we build these features that we know users really want, and they probably should be in the basic product, but they're not. So let's do this, and then maybe when we build the next major version of WordPress, we can kind of look at the most popular pieces of functionality in the Jetpack plugin, and then build, kind of maybe consider those as we build out this new platform.
Yeah, it's a distinct possibility, but I think they also need to look to the plugin community. Okay, what plugins do everybody install? Like, when most people start a new WordPress installation, what plugins do they grab? What do they go for? I would say in the top 10, custom fields, custom post types.
I know the Yoast SEO plugin is one of the most popular ones up there. It's
SEO.
Like, millions of people use that.
Probably repeater fields, because people
I'm not sure what repeater fields are.
So that's a custom field post type.
Custom field inception?
It's essentially a way to make a list view in WordPress. So like something that's not a post, but you can just, or it is posts, but you can sort of create a list view of them. That gets used quite a lot. What else? Probably.
Well, Twitter has their own official plugin to add things like Twitter cards and embedded Twitter specific stuff. And the official Twitter plugin actually taps into the latest Twitter API.
Yeah.
And I actually looked at the details of the plugin, and it looks like it's actually quite lean and does things really nicely. So like stuff like that, I feel like really maybe there should be some kind of collaboration between huge platforms like Twitter and WordPress to make those things work
although,
together.
Although at the same time, to remain open source, I kind of feel like they can't include it in the source code.
But what about CMSs like Ghost? I mean, they have a paid, they have a paid platform, but it's also open source, and they have things like Twitter tags and open graph tags built into their CMS.
They have the tags.
Yeah, the tags.
Do they have the actual API stuff?
No.
Okay.
That's different.
Yeah. So that would probably still need to be a plugin.
Right. Okay. But basic stuff could be added.
They could do that. But yeah, the actual API would still probably have to be a plugin. WordPress, like default vanilla WordPress, at this point in 2015, almost 2016, nobody uses it. The WordPress that you see most of the time is never vanilla WordPress. It's WordPress plus at least 10 plugins, depending on what somebody wants to do. So like, let's say you're doing a store. Chances are that'll be WordPress plus custom fields plus whatever plus custom category stuff plus custom permalink nonsense plus Shopify plus whatever else. And then you hope it all works. It's a house of cards. And until they build a stronger foundation, they continually run the risk of it all falling apart. Plus, although they do a fairly good job of updating security, WordPress is inherently insecure. There's a lot there that can be exploited. Like, it's not HTTPS by default.
Yeah, well, that's...
There's...
Yeah, but how could they enforce that on a self-hosted installation, though? You still have to buy your own SSL certificate, right?
Yeah.
That's why they have WordPress.com.
There's a lot of things that... And I guess that's really one of the big problems. It's like, they can't assume anything. They can't assume, oh, well, someone's obviously going to install it with this and do these things. Like, that would be further opinionation. And they have to avoid that sort of opinionation, because then you would have a platform that assumes that people are going to set up their installation in a particular way that WordPress intends. And 9 times out of 10, that never happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough with, I think with self-hosted, they would have to, I think they would have to have some guidelines that strongly suggest, you know, do not install this under any circumstances in a non-encrypted environment, you know, and I think those kind of things will get better over time. Now that we have these sort of emergent solutions with SSL, like Let's Encrypt, right? That's the one I was trying to remember. But those kind of things, I think, are going to make things a lot easier for people that are just maybe starting out and don't want to buy an SSL certificate necessarily, because they can get expensive.
I don't think they should cost money, to be honest.
I agree with you, but the problem is that now we have an established industry that it's a business model, right? Issuing certificates.
Let them burn down.
I agree. I think the internet should be... I actually firmly believe that the... And I think publicly... Steve Gibson, actually, a famous security researcher who does the Security Now podcast on the Twit network, he's actually said many times, like, the internet, like, across the board in 2015, there's no reason why we should not be using encryption end-to-end. There is no cost to performance anymore. It's not like it was 10, 15 years ago. Like, running SSL now is, like, there's no reason why you shouldn't be using it. You know, and of course, I can, you know, when you buy SSL certificates, you can shop around and get some pretty cheap ones. Like, there are websites that, like, are resellers, and they somehow get, I don't know how they manage this, but they get these deals on SSL certificates. Like, I got a Komodo SSL certificate for, like, a single domain for like, $8. Yeah, totally valid, but they have these deals where you can get these soup. If you just, like, do a search for, like, a Google search for cheap SSL certs, you'll find, like, one of those sites that just, like, they give you these deals. I don't know how they do it, but they manage to do it. They have some kind of buying power, and they just buy them and then reissue them at cheap prices or something. I don't know exactly how all of that works, but you can get them cheap, but I agree. SSL, that should just be, like... That should be a thing that should just be by default, but it's so hard because the internet is now so old and we've built this infrastructure on not encryption. So it's like, it's an afterthought. It has to be, you have to be mindful of, like, yes, I'm building something and I'm going to go out and get this SSL certificate. I'm going to encrypt my site. But you know, that stuff will change probably quicker than we would like, because now, you know, big search engines like Google are prioritizing and favoring sites that are encrypted. You know, and you could argue that you don't really need it, but honestly, like, even on my own blog, I have an SSL certificate, a standard SSL cert, and there's no kind of transactions that are done on my website that would really technically require, other than maybe if you were to use a contact form where you're submitting an email address and you don't want it sent in the clear, or you know, other things like that. But I mean, for just basic simple websites, you could argue that you don't need an SSL certificate. But I added one anyway because I know Google is now favoring those sites, so perhaps more and more people will sort of jump on that bandwagon.
Yeah, I think it's really inevitable, especially for anyone that wants to sell something on the internet. Well, like that
Medium, look at medium.com, which is a huge platform now for publishing content, and it's encrypted.
With Let's Encrypt, I think we're basically going to see the beginnings of widespread adoption. Like we'll probably get to probably 50 to 75% by the end of 2016, just because you can literally just type one line into a terminal and Let's Encrypt builds a certificate for you.
That would be amazing, because that's the current process, not only just buying an SSL certificate is annoying, but the whole technical process of issuing a certificate, generating the key, submitting it, installing it on the server, like yeah. it's too technical for most people to really do. Like my dad wouldn't be going through that process, I can tell you right now.
I think that still is going to be one of the barriers to entry. Like I don't think it'll ever be as simple as fill in this wizard and then you're encrypted, everything's good.
Like what I don't understand is, why can't we make this part of the domain registration process? When you, like, why aren't domain registrars just doing that?
Well, they could with Let's and well,
like if I buy a domain, just make it like, because I buy that domain is associated with my personal address and with my information. So you can verify that it's really me that owns that site and is running that site. So why couldn't you issue a certificate?
I don't see why not. I guess the registrars could start embracing Let's Encrypt, and then they would generate the certificate, give you the key, and then all you would have to do at that point is just put it on your site. And then web hosts could then have a one-click option for that, in theory. I suppose the process could be fairly streamlined, but I don't think it would ever be as simple as click this button. I mean, maybe I'll be proven wrong, but...
But I think we have to get to that level of simplicity
we
at
do.
Some point.
We do.
I don't know if it's going to take 5 or 10 years or 15 years, but
yeah, I don't know how we get there, and I think we might have to just come up with a new method. Like there's a lot of inherent issues with the current setup where it just makes it really difficult for the layman to kind of set it up. And you can try and obfuscate that process, but in the end, you're still going to have to do something that requires technical knowledge. So, yeah, it's hard to say exactly how this will pan out for the average person, but I think like major web developers, major websites, you'll pretty much see full saturation within a year or so, but for like mom and pop, I don't know how long that'll take.
Well, what's going on in the world of media? I see that PlayStation Experience 2015 announced PS2 games launching on PS4 tomorrow, an announcement by Shuhei Yoshida, which we all know and love. It seems like just a handful of titles, but they did more than just release the original games, which they could have, but apparently they are going to upscale them to 1080p and add things like trophy support and some other modern things that people sort of expect. But people seem to be pretty upset, Michael, at the pricing of these games, and I'm not quite sure I really understand this.
I'm not sure I understand it either. I mean, on the one hand, people love to complain. On the other hand, they're reselling games that everyone already has or has owned in the past for $15.
But here's the thing. If you don't really care, like if you own these games and you've played them, no one's forcing you to buy them again.
No.
So if you don't really care, then why even complain?
Because people love to complain.
But that's the thing. It's like, to me, the people that are complaining are the ones that really do want to play these games again on the PS4. They're just mad that this company hasn't given these games to them again for free. But
well,
it's like,
I don't think they should give them out for free. Like, there's essentially no way to prove that you owned these games. Because the PS2 discs, well, actually, no, the PS2 discs could be read by the PS4, but that would get really complicated, and there's probably a really good technical answer for why that wouldn't work. It's a digital download. They have to charge something. I guess people are just...
It's not like they're asking you to pay $60 for these PS2 games.
But I mean,
$5 to me seems like a trivial amount of money for the amount of work that they did to actually bring these to this new platform. And people were complaining about backwards compatibility from day one. And now we have services like PS Now, and they're adding more games all the time to it. So the fact that they're charging $15, I'm like, to me, that's really not a lot of money for a game that, you know, if I did play, for example, one of the games that they're releasing is Grand Theft Auto Vice City. I never actually did get a chance to finish that game in its entirety because it was so massive. And I lost my game saves. Long story. We're not going to go there. But, you know, $15 to relive memories of Grand Theft Auto Vice City and, you know, have it look okay on my HD TV, that's a pretty good deal. I mean, yes, I know you can get maybe these games on Steam for cheaper, but those games haven't been upscaled.
I'm honestly not sure. I mean, the PC versions of these games always were better because, of course, hashtag PC Master Race, etc. But I don't know if they are necessarily as good or better, or it's unclear, but I think the price point is just where it's sticking in people's minds. Like, they look at Steam and they go, oh, I can buy all these games for $4.99, $5.99, $2.99. When there's a Steam sale, they're like $1.99. And here's Sony charging $15. Where do they get off, etc.?
Well, it's like the whole thing with the App Store, right? People complaining about they're used to spending 99 cents. They're charging $4.99 for this game. This is a ripoff. This is an injustice.
Yeah, exactly. It's the exact same phenomenon. It's like people just see the price point and they don't think, oh, well, they've probably cleaned it up a lot. They've added all these extra things. They've added remote play. They've added trophies. They've upscaled the graphics. Like, they've done work on these titles. They haven't just slapped a compatibility sticker on them and thrown them onto the store. They actually did some work.
You know what would have happened if they did that, though? And they released, say they just did that and then released them for, I don't know, $5 or something. People would buy them and they'd be like, oh, they didn't do anything to the game. It looks exactly the same. They didn't even bother. The textures aren't updated. There's no trophy support. And suddenly, it's like that you can't please these people.
No, you absolutely cannot. Everyone loves to complain. There's no exception. No matter what you do, someone is always going to complain about it. There's no way to win. There's basically no way to win. Witcher 3, they released tons and tons of free DLC, and then they released the paid stuff, and people are like, oh, this is too much money. And someone points out, dude, you're getting an entire new playable area that's like the size of the entire last game in the series. And you're complaining, oh, no, it's still too much money. What is this? I paid $70 for this game. No matter what, there's always going to be something. Always. It doesn't matter. Like, Valve could release Half-Life 3, and it's everything we've always hoped it would be and more. And everyone will pile on the one flaw in the game, whatever it might be. Like, this person's voice is wrong. They replaced the voice actor. How dare they? Suddenly there's an outrage.
There are some people that just like live to find these flaws and exploit them and just complain about it. Professional complainers, which is a term that gets thrown around once in a while, but that's the best way to really, I think, explain who these kind of people are.
You don't have to buy these. No one is forcing you to buy these. If you love the idea of playing Vice City again, if you're like, oh, hey, they updated the graphics, I can get trophies, there's all this other stuff, cool. and that experience is worth something to you, $15 is not that much if you really want it that bad.
And what about if you've never played any of these games? That's an excellent deal. I mean, staying on the topic of Vice City, I mean, that game is, even to this day, that game has a massive world. Like, it's impressive for what they were able to do back then on a PS2. And it's a long game. $15 for, like, I don't know, like 40 plus hours or whatever it takes to complete that game. Like, that is a good value.
The only thing, and this could also be part of it, all of the Grand Theft Auto games are also on iOS. And you can actually buy San Andreas, Grand Theft Auto 3, and Vice City for $13.99 on iOS right now as a bundle. So all three games for the price for less than the price Sony is charging for one of them.
I just went to howlongtobeat.com, where you can search how long it takes to beat a certain game. Mm. And they actually have a really good breakdown. Single player statistics for Grand Theft Auto Vice City. Main story, average 21 hours, 9 minutes. However, if you play it leisurely, 46 hours and 17 minutes.
Wow.
Okay, for $15. Yeah, shut your mouth. Stop complaining.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, main story plus extras, 82 hours of gameplay. 82.
I always have trouble with that interpretation. Like, where do they get these numbers from? Do they get them from speed clearers? Do they get them
That's
from...
That's a good question. I don't know.
Like, someone who's terrible at games? Like, if a triple
Michael,
this, A...
this is information on a web page. It's on the internet. It's accurate, okay?
Right,
Do
yes.
not question it.
Of course.
Everything is accurate.
Yeah.
It must be true.
52% of all statistics are made up.
Yeah, I don't know. Is somebody sitting there with, like, a stopwatch and, like, timing how long it takes, and then they're just averaging all of that data that they aggregate?
I honestly don't know. Like, how does the site say how it works? Like, do people submit times, or how does it work?
I will find out. Let's see.
Because, yeah, I mean, it might take a speed clearer or someone who's just really, really good, like, an evening to beat the game. Like, 4 or 5 hours. If they're just constantly through it.
I maybe Steam tracks it because it looks like they use Steam.
Oh, okay.
It says import and conquer your Steam game. See if a potential game purchase is worth your hard-earned money. Find out how long that backlog will take you to complete.
Oh, God.
But how are they getting this data, though?
Well, it does...
Maybe Steam is doing something in the background.
Steam
where can
does...
get that data
Steam
from the game?
Does say how long you've been playing a game.
Maybe that's
like
what
it does,
is.
It does keep track of how many hours you put into a game sure. overall. But that isn't really an indication of when you've beaten the game, I don't think.
See, I don't know how accurate that data is. I'm sure they're probably taking thousands and thousands of players and sort of averaging that data to try to sort of best estimate
yeah.
that. But like, what if you replay a level like 10 times or 50 times because that's how long it takes you to beat that level? Like, is
exactly.
that counted? That
it's what probably
if you,
counted.
What if you spent 8 hours playing one level because you suck? I mean, that's going to skew the data.
And in the case of Grand Theft Auto, how much of that time is spent dicking around, shooting people and running people over with your car?
The only data that I would say take this data with a grain of salt. The only data that would, in my eyes, that would be accurate is if the actual game publisher who's done the playthrough, like knows exactly how to beat the game. If you do everything perfectly, they could tell you this is how long, like we've timed it, this is how long it takes. But nobody has that data.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could look up speed runs, find the fastest speed run without sequence breaking.
Well, they have
that
data.
Would be a good baseline.
They actually have data on here, speed runs too, for each game, so you can see how long it takes.
Okay. So what's the fastest?
It was like 14 hours or something like ridiculous for Vice City.
Is that for like 100% completion or?
That's a good question. It says here main story. It says main story and then they have a column called polled. I don't know what that is, but there's a number. It says 104. Average 21 hours, 9 minutes. And it says the median is 20 hours, rushed is 14 hours, and leisure is 46 hours.
Okay, so those are averages.
Averages. And then they have a breakdown by, if you want to look at main story plus extras, completionists. It says they polled 41. I'm guessing that's 41 individuals. That's not a lot of people.
Yeah.
Average 50 hours for completionists.
Hmm.
If you were a completionist and you rushed it, it would have taken you 34 hours. And if you're a completionist and you did it leisurely, 114 hours. And then, of course, there's the ultimate, which is all playable content. The average is 30 hours.
Hmm.
But again, that's like they polled 236 players. That's nothing. I don't trust that data.
Yeah, that does seem a little skewed.
I mean, maybe that I think this is good. Like this website's probably useful if you're going to buy a game and you just want a sort of a sense of how long it would be. But yeah, it's not going to be super accurate data.
Yeah. So, and I mean, at the end of the day, does it really matter how long it takes as long as you enjoyed it? But of course, there will be those people that are like, I paid $20 for this and it takes 3 hours for me to beat it? What?
Well, aren't you a... So what else is on your list?
Well, we had the Game Awards last night, so that was kind of cool.
Was this at the PlayStation Experience?
No, different events.
Okay. You're going to have to fill me in on this because I haven't been following it, so...
So the Game Awards, this is the second year that they've run them. I'm terrible. I have no idea who runs it. Or anything. I know Jeff Keighley hosts it. I think he used to do the Game Awards for Spike, or the Video Game Awards as they were known back then. And then I think he got together with some people and decided to make a new Game Awards show. And they held that for the first time last year.
Are there any women there?
Yeah.
Or is it just all dudes?
No, there were quite a few women. Obviously, it might have been tokenism or I don't know, but they did have women on stage. She accepted one award and then she won another award, which was fun. She ended up winning best voice acting or best character work for her story. I don't know if you've heard of that.
No.
I haven't actually played it yet. I just bought it because apparently I need to play it.
What platform is this?
It's on PC.
Oh, I guess I'd have to own one of those then.
It might be on Mac. I'm not sure. But yeah, it seems to be this year's Gone Home, I think. From what I've seen, it's like you're on a police computer and there are these interview tapes and you're supposed to sort of figure out what happened. It's kind of a detective thing. I mean, this is based on my first impression and what little I know of the game. I guess next episode I'll make sure I've played it and then I can talk about it. It won Best Narrative as well. Didn't win Best Indie Game. That went to...
Well, while you're thinking I think it's great that they're featuring less well-known people. You know, I mean, there are certainly so many developers that make really great stuff, but I just don't hear about it because I don't follow, like, I love to play games, but I don't follow the industry maybe as much as some people do. So I miss out on a lot of stuff, but there are a ton of indie developers that are making these amazing games and they don't, you know, it's unfortunate that they don't get the recognition that they perhaps deserve or they should have. So it's great. I will look into this and see if there are any games that look interesting. I should give them a chance. And one thing I've been trying to actually do is play games that are out of my comfort zone. Like if I look at a, like I used to look at a game and go, oh, that game would never interest me. I'm not going to play it. But, you know, I try to play different games now.
Yeah, it's something I've tried to do a lot more as well. Like, I've really gotten into indie games. Like, people just doing this cool thing, I'm like, okay, it's $5. I'm on board for that. And generally, I've really enjoyed it.
Just like that that small indie title that many people don't know about called Destiny, right? Michael, you're playing that, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You've probably never heard of it. It's about Destiny and these superheroic soldier people who go to the moon and other places.
So the Game Awards, and who else was there? Anything interesting?
So probably the biggest news, and I mean, if you've recently stopped being a fan of Double Fine, you might not like this, but Double Fine announced Psychonauts 2 with a catch. It is crowdfunded on Fig, which is a new crowdfunding site where people have the opportunity to become investors in the game, and they will actually get a return on their equity.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is a first for me. I've never heard of that website.
Yeah. So it was actually founded by somebody who used to be at Double Fine and someone else, and they basically decided, well, people always complain, Kickstarter, you back the game and that's it. You get the game, transaction over.
There's no lasting relationship with the developers at all.
You effectively helped to fund the game, but you don't see anything come back. So they decided to do something about that. So Fig has this kind of hybrid model where you still have the backer system that Kickstarter has, put money in, get a reward, and that's it. But you can also choose to become an investor in the product. And there's actually this really helpful little calculator that I think the person that makes the project has to put values into, because with Psychonauts 2, there's a slider and you select, okay, how many units does it sell? And based on how much money you put in, this is the break-even point. This is where you start making money, that sort of thing.
So they base it on the amount of money that you're willing to contribute. So basically, the more money you put in, if they're super successful, you're going to see a bigger return.
Yes.
So like, there's going to be a big difference. If they sell 1 million copies, if I only gave them $100, really, that's not going to do me much good. But if I gave them, say, $10,000, then the chance of me getting something back from that would be greater.
Yeah, exactly.
And well, I think that's actually, correct me if I'm wrong, I've never seen anyone do something like that before, where they're giving an opportunity to people that are not only customers, but now they are going to become involved in the product. So I think that's actually really cool. I think that's special.
Yeah, that is a first. So it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. So far, it's just been for games, but they could theoretically expand to other products as well, I would think, if it's successful. I think it's a great model. Kickstarter was already a great model, but adding the idea of equity, even better.
The only thing that concerns me is I can see maybe in a somewhat distant future where if this becomes like super popular, everyone now on their resume is like a venture capitalist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm an angel investor.
I contributed $500 to this product, this product, this product, and this product.
No, they're successful because of me. Because if they didn't have that $500, they wouldn't have gone anywhere.
Yeah, they wouldn't have been able to buy the one thing that caused them to break through with the product.
That's nothing to do with talent. It's all because that $500 I gave.
Yeah, because they bought that one thing, and then they were like, yeah, now we know how to make the product awesome. And then they sold 1 million units and it was amazing. So that's pretty cool, especially if you're a huge fan of the franchise, which I am. Psychonauts is still one of my favorite games of all time. And a sequel, like, I had basically lost all hope. I thought they would never do a sequel. And the minute they showed that trailer, and at first it wasn't really clear what the trailer was about. It was just this vague sort of thing with a military general and this soldiers giving him this update about this place. Oh, there's mines, sir. Oh, well, send in the Air Force. Well, we can't. There's drones around the island being controlled by a comatose 10-year-old girl who thinks she's herding sheep. And then he goes, well, send in the Psychonauts. And my jaw hit the floor.
Yeah, I never actually played that game, but I remember a ton of people loved that game. And it did look interesting.
It's incredibly, incredibly cool. Written by Eric Walpaw. So
did that launch for what platform? PS2? PS3?
I don't even remember. It was on the original Xbox, I think. So that era,
what, PS3?
I don't think it was ever on Sony. I think it was on Xbox and PC.
Maybe that's why I didn't play it. That's probably why then.
And then it ended up on GOG and Humble Bundle and a few other things, and it kind of got a resurgence. Lifetime sales have only been slightly over a million.
It doesn't seem like a lot.
But at the same time, it's this critically acclaimed cult classic. So, I mean, hopefully this will get more people interested in the original game. It's a great game. If you haven't played it yet, you should. It's only like a pittance on GOG or Humble Store or wherever you want to buy
it. That website, but GOG, I like GOG. It has some nice deals and a lot of that stuff. I don't know if it's all exclusively DRM free, but...
It is.
It is? Okay.
They only sell things that are DRM free.
Yeah, it's great for that kind of thing.
So yeah, if you have not played Psychonauts, go get it. It is amazing, and it will leave you pumped for the sequel, which will only happen if they reach 3.3 million. So far, they're at 1.39 million, and it's only been a day, so I'm pretty optimistic about it. Only catch is it won't come out till 2018, but I'm sure it'll be worth the wait. They did have a... FAQ on the page, and it was like, well, wait a minute, if Psychonauts was such a huge AAA title, how do you only need 3.3 million to develop it? And they gave a very detailed answer that was basically like, the FIG money is only one third of their funding. One third comes from them funding it themselves. The other third comes from a private backer who's agreed to work with them and contribute a third of the money. And the rest of it comes from FIG. So together, all of that money adds up to being able to develop the game.
Have they actually, or do they give it like a detailed breakdown of like, these are all our sources of money, and this source of money gets us allows us to do this. This source of money from here allows us to do X.
No, it was literally just a pie chart of three segments.
All of the various sources of funding that they went to, it's like they needed the sum total of all of that in order to actually develop this game.
Yes. They already have two-thirds of it because they have their money and this mysterious private backer's money. It's not Notch, they say. There was a Twitter exchange last year where Notch was like, hey, we should do Psychonauts 2. Tim Schafer, and he's like, yeah, maybe. And then everyone lost their minds over that and were convinced that it was going to happen, but then it didn't. But now that there's this mysterious private backer, everyone's like, oh my God, Notch is giving all his money to this. But they're swearing that it's not him. He did say he might become an... I think he said he would back it. I don't know if he's going to invest in it, but he's at least backing it. I think he chose the most expensive option or something. So there's that. So one third from FIG, one third from their backer, and one third from them. And that adds up to being able to build a really awesome new game.
Sweet. Well, looking forward to it. And I probably should go back and play the original, but at this point, I don't know how I would actually get access to it, because pretty much... PS4 is where I play most of my games. I don't have a PC, and my MacBook is like 6 years old and not capable. but that's an old game, though. Maybe.
It should still be able to run it, I would think. You could try it. And it's entirely possible that they'll re-release the original on PS4 with the release of Psychonauts 2. Because as part of the FIG reward, they actually announced that if you back and get Psychonauts 2, you get a free download for the original game as well. Which is a bit redundant, because I already have it, like, twice over, but oh well.
Well, I mean, that it makes sense, because you're a big fan of the game. So, well, we should probably wrap on that note. Is there any final thoughts that you had on that?
No, I think anything I might have said would have been about people complaining. Like, people haven't been happy with Double Fine in the recent past over Broken Age and a few other issues. But nothing super egregious. Like, Broken Age basically ran too long. They went over budget. They didn't get the rewards out in time to people. People are still waiting for rewards, that kind of thing. But really, it just kind of speaks to them being inexperienced with this sort of thing. Like, Broken Age was the first really, really big Kickstarter campaign they ran. The one before that was really quite simple, and it didn't involve a lot of scale, but Broken Age did, and they ran into a ton of issues with it. So that left a bunch of people upset. They're still working to make those people happy. In the meantime, they're also going to be working on Psychonauts 2 now, but supposedly those are separate teams, so hopefully everyone will get sorted out in the end. I don't think they're bad guys. I think they will try to make it right with everybody that is still waiting. I am honestly still happy to give them my money because I believe in them as a development studio. I think they can do really cool things. They're not always perfect. Sometimes things run long, sometimes shit happens, but at the end of the day, they make really fun games. So,
and that's what it's all about.
I am perfectly content to give them my money because all I know and all I care about is eventually I will get that Psychonauts 2. Might not be exactly when they promised. It might not be exactly what they've said so far, but it's going to happen and it's going to be awesome.
So it sounds like you have a lot of confidence in their ability to produce a worthy successor.
I think so.
Because isn't that always a troublesome thing? I mean, I know with movies, people are always concerned about sequels and, you know, history tends to repeat itself that sequels tend to be not as good as the initial movie.
True, but sequels usually end up happening only a little while after the original. Whereas Psychonauts 2 is happening practically a decade after the original game. And all of the people that were involved went their separate ways, learned, grew as people, et cetera, et cetera, right. et cetera. And so, now they're all coming back together to make the sequel.
Right.
And
so they've had time to sort of really think this through carefully. This is not just a cash cow. It's not like, oh, we just released this game and now a year later we need to cash in on this IP and
so you're saying
it's the opposite. You're saying it's the opposite of that.
Yeah. I mean, for the longest time, nobody thought this game would happen, ever. So for them to actually be making it, A, they want to make it, B, they have a great idea for what it can be, and C, they think they're going to be able to pull it off and deliver on something that everyone will enjoy. I don't think they would do it if they didn't think they could make it really good. So for this to even be happening is its own endorsement.
Well, I think that's a great spot to end. So thanks for listening to The Impromptu. I'm here with Michael Norton, as always, and I am Alex Knight. This is episode 23. And if you have a moment, please do leave us a rating on iTunes. We would sincerely appreciate it. This show is entirely listener-supported, and by leaving a rating on iTunes, it really helps other people that are not aware of our show's existence to find it, because it's one of those things where, you know, iTunes and podcasts, there's so many podcasts out there, it's really hard for sort of indie people sort of just getting into it or been doing it for a while but haven't seen huge success. So please do that. If you'd like to send us feedback, you can actually go to our website, which is hologramradio.org/contact. You'll find an email address there for the show as well. It's actually theimpromptu@hologramradio.org, so it's pretty easy to figure out and remember. If you'd like to show your support by donating, you can give a buck or two or whatever you feel comfortable with by going to our donation page as well. And also, another great way of showing your support for the show and for our new podcast network is by visiting the sponsors page on Hologram Radio and clicking on one of the Amazon links that we've set up recently for you. We've got links for Amazon Canada, for Amazon USA, and for Amazon UK. By clicking those links, you get the same exact shopping experience that you know and love. Nothing changes. The only difference is when you buy something from Amazon, your folks here get a small percentage of the sale, which really does help us a lot. So that's it for now. And Michael,
thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.